Open.
Outspoken.
It's Ophthalmology Off the Grid.
An honest look at controversial topics in the field. I'm Blake Williamson.
I'm Gary Wirtz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to another new episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid. This month, Dr. Paul Walton joins our host, Dr. Blake Williamson and Gary Wirtz, to share his advice on how to best avoid a potential horror story. Thanks for listening. Support for this podcast comes from Bryn Mawr Communications. BMC produces a number of informative podcast series spanning a variety of topics in ophthalmology. Discover a new show at itube.net/podcasts.
Hey, everybody. It's another episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid here with my main partner in crime, Dr. Gary Wirtz. Gary, how you doing, buddy?
Man, I'm doing great. I am lucky to be here. Very grateful I get to share this experience with you, Blake. You know, we've been doing it for a while. We've both been at this for a while.
How's Lexington right now? Is it warming up down there?
Lexington, this is Keeneland season. You know, we just finished basketball season, unfortunately, with not much luck in the postseason. We got a new coach, so shout out to Mark Pope. He's coming to represent Big Blue Nation, so we're excited about that. Keeneland is going well, and the weather is perfect. It's 80, a little breeze. Got to just go on a walk with my wife, and life is good, man. How's Baton Rouge right now?
We got Jazz Fest next week. Ooh, so I got Young MD Connect in Austin, Texas this weekend, and we got Jazz Fest. So we're pumped up, buddy. That's also wonderful. Pumped up for this episode.
Absolutely. I want to just get right to it and introduce the man, the myth, and the legend, Dr. Paul Walton. For those who don't know Dr. Walton, he is really among the most experienced cataract and refractive surgeons that exist in the United States, probably let alone the world. Paul is fiercely independent. He is the founder and CEO of Eye Specialists of Indiana, so he's not too far away from me. And I've been fortunate enough to see Paul in action. I spent a day with Paul and his surgery center. He was gracious enough a couple of years ago to allow me to see behind the curtain, and I got to see the master at work. And so, Paul, that doesn't even do justice to you know, the depth and breadth of work that you've done. But I want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you for you know, all you have done for our profession, for me personally, and we're really excited to hear your insights about either horror stories or maybe how to prevent those horror stories. So with that, Paul, thank you for coming on your first ever podcast.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Gary and Blake. It's just a pleasure to be at this lofty age and stage of life and never having been on a podcast before. So I hope that'll explain things to you a little bit. I'm trying to stay in the middle of the midlife envelope and not be quite as edgy as I was before and, you know, not end up dead or in a wheelchair or with some horrible life lesson. So I hope that my comments are not too tame and, you know, they're worthy of consideration. My concern as a surgeon is when I train residents and when I think about talking in a forum like this, is really to encourage everyone that's an eye surgeon to seek responsibility as much as they can and upfront. And so when we think about terrifying surgical experiences or cases for us, as I kind of look back on it and I think, well, how about month to month or in the last year or day to day, a lot of things I'd like to share is just algorithms and concepts to review. Perhaps they'll be more valuable for residents and training, but they've really been helpful for me. And they're kind of the touchstones for having a boring day and avoiding an oh my God moment or keeping the can of corner paint up on the shelf, not painting ourselves into a corner. So first thing we really try to do at Eye Specialists is we try to avoid misunderstandings. We want to recognize and treat anxiety in the immediate pre-surgical and in the operating room. We want to communicate well and connect with each patient as an individual. We want to avoid surprises. And gosh, you know, if we can do all those things, it's going to be unusual to have a difficult case bite us and surprise us. The more personal we can make things, the better. Many years ago, for a variety of reasons, we started recording, audio and video recording, 100% of our surgeries and lasers. It was a TQM loop for teaching, and so you capture the interesting cases to present to residents or peers. But also we found that it made us behave much more politely in the operating room. If we knew that we were making a permanent record, almost like showing off, you know, for ourselves. So to be a concierge practice anymore, it's extremely important. And so the things I want to talk about for a couple of minutes here are avoiding misunderstandings, recognizing and treating anxiety, communicating and connecting with patients, and avoiding surprises.
I'm curious, before we get into that, when you decided to make that decision to record 100% of your cases, does that go into the patient's record? Is that an accessible part of their record, or is that just for educational purposes?
Knock on some woody substance. I haven't been sued in 35 years. So when that comes up, and I'm sure it will, maybe I'll provoke it with the wrong podcast statement here. I'm sure that there'll be a question of discovery, but we practice as if we want the record to be admitted.
Right.
That's really important. And so not only just the tone of our conversations and things like that, there are times when patients will complain about what was done or said in the operating room. There's really nothing quite like having a recorded line, whether you choose to share it with them or not, but it exonerates you if you behave. So that goes back to seeking responsibility up front, pursuing excellence, being just as good as we can, and knowing that there's a recorded line. It's also been helpful when we have difficult employees, because the line's always running in the operating room, and sometimes they, you know, press the eject button on their employment by the things they say. And we're not trying to trap anybody, ourselves or patients or employees, but just the knowledge that we're accountable and it's transparent, it's really, really been helpful for us. And if I have an interesting case that I want to share with one of my partners, I get to just pull it up and play it for him. And we can, you know, get our head all the way around it. Same thing for residents.
Absolutely. Blake, one thing I tell my staff, I try to reiterate, is I say, you know, guys, we're always on stage. And what I say is, you know, a snide comment, a side comment, something that you're joking around about that could be taken out of context. You don't know how a patient is going to interpret that, whether that's pre-op, inter-op, post-op, and to remember that, you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that we are always, again, essentially on stage, and people can take what we say out of context or even in context if it's inappropriate. Do you have conversations with your staff about that?
Yeah, work is a theater, the office is a stage, you know, and so they know that, and we get routinely complimented by our staff. And the one thing that Paul said, that just jumped out at me is all of this is in pursuit of a boring day. And that's absolutely correct. That's exactly correct. I mean, and so when you do high volume cataract surgery, like all of us do on this call, you know, that is your goal, is to have a peaceful, relaxing, some may call it boring, I think that's a great way to describe it, day. And we look forward to that. People say, oh gosh, you don't want to do, you know, all these different things. You just want to do the, you know, cataract surgery, lots and lots of cataract. I'm like, yes, but there's a beauty in getting it perfected, not just from the surgical thing, but from everything else in the periphery, like Paul was discussing.
Exactly. Paul, I don't mean to take us too far from what you're saying, but I thought it was really interesting that you made that decision. I just wanted to highlight some of the nuances around that decision, because it really makes a difference, I think, in how you pursue excellence. And I compliment you on that.
Well, it's an audio podcast, so we're painting the picture with words. And so I'm going to say a couple of things that paint the picture for anyone interested in how we do things at our office. For one thing, we hold hands. We have, we don't have CRNAs and MD anesthesiologists, but we have a hand anesthesiologist, which is a staff member that gives good hand, that likes to hold hands with patients during surgery for comfort, remind the patients not to put their hands up towards their face, and to just be another presence in the room. I've seen anesthesia personnel hold hands for patients, but usually they're abstracted on something else. So we have a hand anesthesiologist, if you will, ha ha, but it's really a nice thing, and it's comforting to our patients. it comes together as, you know, what people will say sometimes, it's a well-oiled machine, or you guys are amazing, everybody's so nice. But holding hands and then saying the patient's name over and over. We have 3x5 cards and 5x8 cards with the patient's first name above their head in the preoperative area and in the operative room. So that suppose a patient starts to get a little frisky during surgery, we can all look up and say, hey, June, take it easy, sister. We know her name right away. And we probably have made it a point to say her name several times while we're holding her hands and putting eye drops in and talking to her about the surgery. But we use the patient's first name. And we always want all staff members to be able to see the patient's name. It's just as important as being able to see their pulse oximetry output in terms of how are they doing and how are we doing. Because when patients start to move or need to be reoriented, we all need to be able to look at just a second with our eyes. We can come away from the scope, or the scrub assistant or the nurse can, circulating nurse, the hand anesthesiologist, anybody can say, hey, June, don't kick your feet, sweetheart. You know, everything's cool. And it just brings them back to center. So holding hands, having the patient's name always available and using it a lot. We want to be aware of a category of patients that are really going to give us a hard time. I think all surgeons that I know have a hard time when patients get the so-called sundowner syndrome, when they start getting disoriented, maybe fogged a little bit from sedation, and a person that's starting to lose their memory or have short-term attention deficit issues, or they're frankly demented already, and they merit cataract surgery. They're humans and we want to help people. Those can be very hard patients to take care of when they're in and out of contact with reality. So we put them in a very unusual circumstance in cataract surgery. And so minimal, less is more. We use maybe 1 milligram of Versed for these patients. We continuously talk to them. We don't want them to go to sleep, because particularly when they wake up, they don't know where they are. And if they have a drape on their face or some strange person holding their hand or something, it could be too much for them. So the so-called demented patient or the confused patient, the Alzheimer's patient, is a real corner that I want to talk about of our game today. And then also the deaf patient is a separate category, but it's also a sphincter tightener for all of us cataract surgeons. If we have a patient that's awake that we cannot communicate with, oh man, you know, it's not so great. And we're going to just set aside for a minute the propofol and the ways to general anesthesia and the ways to put people out. Those are maybe safer, you know, proactive ways to deal with some of these patients. But it's also a situation where suppose we're doing the first cataract on a patient and we end up having kind of a rowdy ride. You know, we get in on the monkey motion and we get through it, but we think, ah, man, not sure I want to do that again. Usually always the answer is do the same patient with 1/3 of the sedation. If you're trying to communicate well, or you don't want the patient to drop off to sleep and then come back with a startle, then don't let them really go to sleep and keep talking to them or humming to them or whistling or singing or holding their hand, whatever it is. So we try to stay connected with these patients that don't have a good connection like we do with our situational awareness and everything that's going on. I mentioned a couple more things, if I might. Topical anesthetic. I found that using 1/2 strength proparacaine admixed with moxifloxacin is really nice. You'd never get SPK from it. It's just as potent as a topical anesthetic. And it doesn't sting quite as much. It seems to work just as well, and you put it in multiple times. And we just don't get SPK, and we don't have a fragile epithelium on our cataract patients. So the FDA approved proparacaine is about twice as strong, I think, is what we really need. In the same way, the intraocular xylocaine, we use a dilution that results in 0.4% in the anterior chamber. And unlike almost all the normal 1% and 2% xylocaine preparations, it does not sting when it first goes in the eye. And yet it's sufficiently anesthetic for the iris and so forth. So we've sort of numbed down our numbing medicine, if you will, a little bit. We've also started to use topical viscous xylocaine on the skin around the eyelids and the face, so that when the drape comes off at the end of the case, it doesn't hurt. Have you noticed that? How everybody's like, oh, that was the worst part of the operation. You took my face off.
I've heard that as often as I don't remember any of this from the first surgery.
And that's the second eye syndrome. Absolutely. Yeah. So we've started to just administer the topical viscous Iocane immediately before surgery. And then we put the drape on and the drape will stick. But then when it comes off at the end of the case, at least 9 out of 10 times, the patients don't even comment. And wow. I've done it for decades where every single patient, it's like, it's over, Kmart, go and close and you got to go home. You know, it's almost like a wake up call to take that drape off. It's so unnecessary. And I didn't realize it was unnecessary until fairly recently. So I would encourage the single use topicals, Iocane gel, right before putting the sticky drape on, dilute proparacaine on the eye and dilute Xylocaine in the eye. It's very much a case where less is more. And the patient, the last thing they remember is, you know, waking up and the drape pulling off their skin. It's really quite uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's interesting. Blake, I would be very curious. This is sort of like it's like a dipstick. You try to figure out, you know, where are other people in other practices around the country? What are they doing for anesthesia? What is your typical, let's say, low, medium, and high dose patient for cataract surgery? What are you giving them on average? What are you starting with? And where do you go from there? And what are your tricks?
Yeah, our anesthesia, I think that we're kind of old school, and I think that we are less innovative, and I think that we are less nimble when it comes to anesthesia. You hear people going all the way from giving absolutely nothing or just, you know, proparacaine and maybe like a Xanax to people who are full scale, full tilt, just like we still are. So we have an MD anesthesiologist in the room and he's doing Versed and propofol. You know, usually for most patients, some patients that, you know, and I have, you know, 10 anesthesiologists that sort of rotate through in our group. And some of them give fentanyl, some of them are mostly just Versed, some of them will do a touch of propofol and none of the others. It just depends on them that day. And frankly, I'm embarrassed to say that I have not really gotten too deep in the weeds on that. If I have a patient who comes in saying, hey, listen, I've had a horrible reaction to anesthesia, typically I'll just do topical only. We won't push anything through the IV. We'll start an IV, but we won't push anything.
Right.
And then similarly, if I have that patient that says, doc, I don't want to remember a single thing. And when they talk about MKO melt and all these things, and it's amazing, you don't have to have a needle stick. My comeback is, in my market, more than anything, I hear people say, I don't remember anything. I want to be completely knocked out, you know? And so for us, that's why we're still, you know, giving intravenous medication to achieve that. But yeah. I don't know that I put them into buckets and sort of titrate what anesthesia they get. Maybe I should be doing that.
It's something I've been kind of interested in. And, you know, this kind of goes back to, I think, something that Paul might have been the first one in the country or maybe an early person to advocate for was ketamine. And so in our practice, we generally will give them some IV Versed in the holding area. So while they're getting ready, they're getting maybe 1 or 2 milligrams of Versed just to kind of chill them out. That's about a 20-minute experience in the pre-op area. So if we had given them, you know, Valium or something, that's barely enough time for it to even start working before they get into the operating room. And so giving them a little Versed in pre-op area, we have found to be pretty helpful at just getting them relaxed and lowering their blood pressure and getting them calm enough to roll back in for their laser cataract part or actually the OR. And then it's interesting, over the past, I would say since COVID, I've noticed a real uptick in the amount of Versed and other agents that we have to give. I would say, and this may be regional, so Kentucky, we may have weird things in the water here, but I'm giving probably, I would say, 60-year-olds and below, I'm giving about 3 to 4 milligrams of Versed, 10 of ketamine, and 50 mics of fentanyl. And that's usually enough. Obviously, we don't start there, but we titrate there. On the second eye, we tend not to give ketamine on the first eye, so we can reserve it for the second eye. So second eyes, we give ketamine to. So the experience seems a little different than the first eye. And I'll give them 1 more milligram of Versed and 10 milligrams of ketamine on their second eye. If they're in their 70s, that's probably 2 to 3 milligrams of Versed with the other agents as well. And if they're in their 80s, I refuse to give more than 2 milligrams of Versed, whether they have dementia or not. I have found more than 2 milligrams of Versed for patients who are pushing 80 or over 80. I say it causes them to go over the rainbow. They go into, they're in Oz and they don't know where they are. So we tend to titrate more with fentanyl in our older patients because fentanyl is sort of just turning the dial down, whereas Versed sort of, it's like the Wonka Vader. You don't know which direction you're going. Paul, what are your thoughts on that?
Wow. I feel like I've got some new brothers here. You're the first ophthalmologist that want to talk about doses of sedation, and I'm happy in my tickly parts. Thank you. We use what we call the base coat, something like Gary was talking about, which is usually 3 milligrams of Versed preoperatively after we've met the patient. Why don't you stop there for a second? The surgeons meet the patient in our center, and we kind of take a quick look at the patient. We try to get to know them right away. And sometimes it's the two most important things that we insist on before we start administering sedation is we want to see the chart, and we want to see who the referring doctor is, if there's a referring doctor. In our case, there usually is. And what the patient's occupation or previous occupation was. Don't you find that patients select the kind of doctor that is like them or that they like? And there are some docs that are like OCD, tightly wound, hyper, picky, fussy, and that's the way their patients are. And then there are some that are just kind of like, hey, groovy, karma, dude, kumbaya, you know, I want to look in the eclipse with no glasses. And those are patients that are tuned to their primary care doctor. So
you just described the difference between me and Blake, I think. Inadvertently. I'm the fussy and picky and OCD when I think of the two of us.
Yeah, for sure. But anyway, aren't we trying to get a quick picture of the patient before we start talking to them and selecting their surgical approach and managing them during the surgery, but also choosing sedation if we choose to do that? So in our cases, it's usually 2 or 3 milligrams of Versed preoperatively. And then we've tried to avoid, we're using the same three agents, Gary, that you talked about, Versed, fentanyl, and ketamine. It's almost all a Versed world. It's a base coat out front. The patient can usually talk when they come to the operating room. We do the same video and audio recorded attestation. People call it a timeout. We get the patient to recite their chief complaint in the operative eye and state that they would like to see better after cataract surgery. That just kind of gets put into the background. We've already attested to that in other ways, but it's just nice to have it again for that dark day where somebody wants to challenge you for doing unnecessary surgery. Again, I've not had that, thank goodness, but the accusation's always around the corner for high volume surgeons that we're not doing the right thing for our patients. So it's nice to have the patient say, heck yeah, doc, I want to drive at night. I can't see the signs and I want to read. So we like to have them at least awake enough to do a good functional timeout. And then in the operating room, we're usually supplementing them with fentanyl, occasionally with ketamine. But fentanyl seems to be our number two, our second wave. And it's usually 25 mics for females and 50 for males, unless, you know, some other, like you said, the second eye syndrome or some untoward reaction. I find that, like you, I wouldn't want to be with a melt. And we've tried nitrous oxide, and that's its own trip for refractive surgery. That's another talk for another day. But as surgeons, we have an obligation to be in charge and to be in control and to be responsible. And an IV is 100 times more in charge than a melt or talk or something like that. And so we like to have the short-acting agent. We need to supplement a patient because their saccades are too fast to have cataract surgery. You can tell by just looking at them, their eyes are moving too fast. That's a Versed game. By the time the surgeon's in the room, you put another milligram or two of Versed, and that's going to just stop. You might not go to sleep, but the anxiety goes down and the rapid eye movements go way down. Fentanyl, in my view, has a 10-minute fuse. From the time you administer it until it's at its depth IV, it's 10 minutes. And usually, by the time I come in the room, I want the operation to be over in 10 minutes. So I'm putting it in and kind of expecting them to get a little quieter, like you said, and to get a little slow down. If at the beginning of the case, we want the patient to show us where their axial visual axis is by looking into the microscope and using a fixation device to mark where we want the toric lens offset, if there's an offset, or the multifocal lens offset, if there's going to be an offset within the giant 9 millimeter pupil. We mark all those things when the patient's still kind of sober and they're talking to us and they're looking at the light. But we know in 5 or 10 minutes, the fent is going to, you know, make it all numb. And so we avoid, actually, guys, to answer your question, we avoid three agents in the same patient. We find that there's just too much throwing up going on. So we'll do Versed and Fent. Most of the time we'll do Versed and ketamine if the patient has a history of opioid troubles or other reasons. They've just read too much in the newspaper and they don't want to have opioids. Okay, then you can have ketamine. It's a cool thing. It's its own trip, so to speak. But we don't want to have Versed and ketamine and Fent in the same patient. I think those three are not the Holy Trinity. I think they should be two at a time in my long experience. Also, in my opinion, I know I've shared this with Lance and with Gary, 6 to 8 milligrams of ketamine is the max for us under any circumstance. We won't repeat it because there are patients that get that so-called emergence phenomenon. They get very troubled and anxious and they remember it and they wish you didn't give them that medicine, or they'll throw up. So our personal limit is kind of the joy of 6 or maybe 8 milligrams of ketamine when we use ketamine. And it's got an extremely short half-life. It doubles the Versed functionally for about 5 minutes, which is just right for cataract surgery. And then it's all gone. So it's got its own charming half-life. But we use 2 out of 3 of those agents. And in our case, just to give you a long answer to a short question, it's Versed pre-op for the base coat, and then a small amount of Fent to get the, you know, get the room a little bit quieter, and then establish the axial visual axis, mark that with a pair of syntheses or some other way, so that at the end of the surgery, we know where the axial visual axis is when the patient has ceased to participate in the operation. Does that make sense?
Yeah. We're also giving everyone, we decided to pre-treat every patient with Zofran IV as well. So we found that to be really helpful, but maybe that's because we are giving 3 agents pretty commonly. So, but just as a disclaimer, we do treat everyone with Zofran. And so even though we've not talked specifically about, you know, horror stories this time, I think this podcast in particular is going to help a lot of surgeons prevent the horror stories and prevent the stress and may prolong a few careers because of the wisdom that Paul has shared. So with that, Paul, we just want to thank you so much for being willing to come on. You're always welcome to come back, and we appreciate what you've done for us tonight and for the field in general. So with that, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, and thank you for making me feel so welcome, fellas.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Ophthalmology Off the Grid, and thank you to our guest, Dr. Nate Radcliffe. Tune in to future episodes to hear more horror stories from top ophthalmic surgeons.